delighted Steve because of interest in a book that he's, have you written it already? Or is it?
It's coming out in March.
It's coming out in March, which is looking at the future of the intellectual, and I thought that this was a really appropriate topic in relation to this exhibition. So.
Okay, I hope you don't mind, I'm going to tape this, so I'll just put the thing down here, it won't be a problem. No, the book is definitely coming out as it is. And by the way, those of you who are interested in the status of the intellectual in the university, I just would alert you that other than my book, which will be out in the beginning of March, there will be a debate here at the Warwick Arts Center on May 16th between myself and Frank Verrini, who last year wrote a book also on the intellectual, and that will be sponsored by the sociology department. So keep an eye out for that. The advertisements for that should be coming out in the next few weeks, I would imagine. And it'll be somewhere here, being one of the big lecture halls here, because we're anticipating to be sort of a large audience for this. My interest in this actually isn't just to restrict it to the business of intellectuals, but actually to the business of the university. I've written quite a lot on that, and on the future of the university, especially in a time when there's a sense in which what is distinctive about universities is up for grabs. And the way I want to talk about this is in terms of sort of, since we've got this exhibit here, which in a sense emphasizes the spatial aspect of the university, one might want to think about what's the relationship between the space in which the university is contained and the concept that the university stands for. Okay, and so in a sense that's kind of the issues that I want to raise here. The first thing to bring out is that I want to use a campus like Warwick, which is sort of in the middle of nowhere, and kind of a dedicated campus, for a university. It's not just using other buildings that already exist for academic purposes. As kind of the sort of paradigm case, the exemplar of the university as a space. Okay, and in a sense, a lot of the campuses that were built in this country in the 1960s were very much modeled on a sort of American idealized view of what a university campus should be like, which would be sort of out of town, right, in a dedicated space. Which with specially built buildings for the occasion. Now I think it's very important to think about how distinctive that is as a kind of thing to do. Because if you go back through history, of course, if you wanted to find out about esoteric forms of knowledge, sort of what the smartest people are doing, the typical way of doing it would be through tutorial. So you might actually go to the chambers, and you still have sort of remnants of that in Oxford and Cambridge, right, where you go to the rooms of the person who's quite knowledgeable, and then you get this wisdom imparted to you on sort of one-to-one basis. In a sense, you don't need specially dedicated rooms like lecture halls, or even seminar rooms, for that matter. You can just sort of talk to the people there who actually know this stuff, and you sort of impart it on a person-to-person basis, and the model is kind of an apprenticeship model, you might say, just like, with regard to manual skills in a guild, you learn from a master. It was that kind of idea. Now, the idea that you actually want to sort of teach people on math had a lot to do with kind of the reasons why we're encouraging people to go to university today, which has to do with professional training. That is to say, training, getting skills that will enable you to get jobs. But in this case, the kinds of jobs we're talking about in the Middle Ages are jobs having to do law, medicine, theology, where basically you would have a kind of civil or ecclesiastical position once you got the degree, and you'd go out there and sort of participate in the governance of the Holy Roman Empire or whatever. Okay? And so in that context, there was need to sort of be able to sort of teach people on math in a kind of dictatorial manner and to give them the degree. This is where the doctor's degree originally comes from. Okay? So we already have this kind of stuff in the Western world by the 12th century. And so then the question becomes, what about the idea that in some sense one might want to teach sort of esoteric research, but not because one necessarily is going to be contributing to that, so not like working with the great master, but at the same time not because there's some kind of specific job-related thing at the end of the day. Right? In other words, some kind of in-between state. And that kind of in-between state is actually the basis for the university as a very distinctive, dedicated kind of institution, something other than a glorified vocational school or a cult, right? And there's a sense in which it could be pulled in either direction. And so this is where the issue of education, kind of general education, and the idea of curriculum becomes very important. And curriculum was the idea that, in the course of study, you study many different things in the round. And so when you had a university campus that was just dedicated to the curriculum in that sense, each building would be kind of a place for a specific body of knowledge where the lectures would be held or the seminars would be held. And especially, well, even in this country, but especially American campuses, you can still see buildings often named by discipline, right? That's kind of a remnant of this kind of attitude. And the idea was this was supposed to be in the round where the campus, the green space, is kind of in the middle. Okay, so there's a sense in which the spatial character of the university represents this kind of general knowledge, which anyone going through should be able to get, regardless of whatever specialized job they're going to get afterwards or anything like that. Now this, of course, led to enormous, and this is where you start to get the university as an institution other than just glorified professional school. And this leads to enormous controversy almost from the outset, because the idea is people learning all these different types of knowledge, but aren't necessarily being trained to go into any specific social function. That's kind of like wild cards, right? And of course people then start saying all kinds of stuff to all kinds of people, moving around as they see fit. I mean, these are people who typically would have master's degrees rather than doctorates. See, doctorates is kind of the establishment degree. The master's degree was the one that gave you the right to teach, but the doctorate degree was the one that gave you the right to administer. Okay. So people who got the MA would be just floating around causing all kinds of trouble, establishing universities in other places, right, and basically just disrupting local authorities. Okay. And this is kind of how universities spread throughout Europe, and of course as this got more and more involved with religious dissent, which is kind of typically the place where, you know, kind of the terms in which disagreement and dissent was focused for certainly the first 300, 400, maybe even 500 years. Start to get these different university campuses with their different slants to them, okay? But each of them, as it were, dedicated places for knowledge. Now, the way these things were done, you know, because universities, in a sense, kind of get formed very much in a dissenting pattern, so like Cambridge dissenters from Oxford, okay, and then dissenters from Cambridge found Durham, you know, several hundred years later. I mean, that's kind of the story of universities in this country, okay? There's a sense in which the issue of university governance becomes quite interesting. So what exactly is the relationship between the masters trying to liberate you from your taken for granted beliefs in these various subjects and the students who are coming in to matriculate? Especially since all of them are sort of living in the same place, right? They're all living on the campus. Okay? And again, take Oxford and Cambridge as kind of a model here. Well, this has always been a source of a lot of controversy. And in a sense, the controversy continues to have significance into the modern period. Before I go into that, thinking about the student revolts, for example, in the 1960s, right? Let's think about it in the beginning. In the beginning, the way governance was understood, university governance, was that students did participate. And in fact, students were responsible for sort of, as it were, you know, sort of securing their own peace amongst themselves, right? So that there couldn't be, you couldn't, like, start causing trouble in the local countryside or the towns or anything like that. And so, typically the way the university distributed students was according to speaking a common language. And so each person who spoke the same language would be in the same residence hall, essentially. And these residence halls in medieval Latin was called nationes, which is the basis for our word nation. Okay? And that's the first real systematic use of the term. Now, the interesting thing about this, especially if you look at it historically, and you think about the history of sort of emancipatory politics, especially in the 19th and 20th century, very often the people who turn out to be revolutionaries in their respective countries, you know, at some point met at a university, very often overseas, right, and as it were, didn't know each other in advance, but got kind of thrown together in a common residence hall by virtue of having spoken a common language, and they were to manage themselves in some kind of way. And it's in that context that they then sort of together cook up what turned out to be these radical ideas that then they bring back to the homeland and start all kinds of trouble there. Okay? And this is quite a common pattern that you find. And in fact, even in the United States, there's a kind of mild version of this kind of thing in the origin of the country. As you know, nowadays in the United States, there's all these fraternities and sororities on the campus. And they're sort of the descendants of this kind of thing that I'm talking about, except, of course, everybody, you know, for the most part, is American within them. But the interesting thing was that during the American Revolution, the war for independence, these fraternities actually played a very important role among students who were very interested in getting the independence from this country. And they housed the soldiers from France, in particular. Okay, and one particular fraternity, Phi Beta Kappa, which is now known as the sort of academic began life as a place for housing these kind of revolutionary French soldiers who were on the sides of the Republicans in America, right, to propose, you know, sort of hide them out there. Because there was an autonomy given to student governance in those kinds of houses, so nobody was going to check to see what was going on in there, okay? And this was the place, this was the College of William and Mary in particular, which was at once the place where colonial administrators in America were being trained, but also the place where people like Thomas Jefferson graduated, okay? So this is, this sort of thing continues very much. Now, when you get to the 1960s, and you have the campus revolt, even though by that time most of the students are kind of living off campus, I mean, you still have people, the undergraduates living on the campus in America. And I think by European standards, it's really striking the percentage of undergraduates who continue to live on campus in the United States. Because the university will go out of its way to build enormous amounts of buildings, right, in a way in which in this country we would just say, go find some place in the city to live in, right? But the thing is that even though a lot of the students had already, you know, lived off campus by the 1960s, nevertheless, they saw themselves as part of this thing, the university. And there was a sense in which they wanted the same standards to apply to themselves as to the faculty. And, if, and in the United States in particular, where most of these kind of revolts occurred, the big problem was that a lot of the faculty were actually holding consultancies and government contracts that were involved in the Vietnam War and things like this, whereas students were explicitly prohibited from getting involved in any kind of political activity. And it was the double standard that was the thing that in most cases led to students' revolt. Now you might say, well, where does this idea that students have to be treated the same way as faculty come from? Well, the idea that both of them, in some sense, are joint governors of this common space known as the university campus. That is kind of the historic root of this, which of course by the 1960s doesn't quite look so plausible anymore, but that is kind of the spiritual root of that thing, that both the students and the faculty are co-equal presence. And again, you know, if you think about the few dons who still live in places like Oxford, right, with the students, right? That's the physical model that we're talking about originally for this kind of thing. Now, I think there's a, that this, so, you know, in a sense, what am I saying with all this? Well, it seems to me that the physical space of the university has an enormous amount of symbolism. It's very deep in terms of, you know, who's got a stake and what happens, and kind of, as it were, a symbol of why we should be concerned, like, why should students be concerned about what faculty are doing? And also why faculty should be concerned about what students are doing, too. I mean, there's that aspect as well, which in a sense has been much more prominent with the idea of, you know, being a student. You know, if you're a teacher of a student, you're somehow in loco parentis, right? You're sort of in the place of the parent. I mean, so there's that side of it as well. But the point is that idea, that whole idea of the university as a common space for the faculty and the students is one that is kind of born of there being a common physical space. Now, of course, you know, as we move now into the 21st century, right, the whole business of the campus as a physical space where students need to spend lots of time, or even where even faculty need to spend lots of time, right, is kind of disappearing, right? And already there are a lot of universities, including major ones, where offices are sort of hot desks, right, where, you know, all kinds of different people can be being in the same office at a given time, just when they're doing that very specific function like holding office hours or something like that. And it seems to me that this kind of movement, whereby the university, you know, is kind of a glorified car park or just sort of a glorified space, you know, where you put your hat down for a few minutes to do a few kind of routine things, but isn't really what you identify with most in terms of your intellectual life, I think is potentially extremely damaging. Because then there becomes a sense in which what is it that you end up wanting to defend? And I think we see this nowadays in a very specific way. And it's the kind of thing that public intellectuals complain about a lot. And this has a lot to do, in a sense, with specialization in academia, where there's a sense in which academics, all of us, I think, identify more with the specific discipline or expertise that we have. You know, and we're dealing with colleagues on the internet and conferences and stuff like that, and specialized articles that we write in journals, that we do that more, we identify with that more than we do with the university, that is to say, the people in our own campus who are in different subjects, who are in a sense joined by a common faith by virtue of being members of the same institution. I mean, that kind of sense of affiliation is really disappearing, okay? But at the same time, it is that affiliation that in fact is what is sociologically responsible for maintaining the autonomy of knowledge. Because Because the autonomy of knowledge is not just some sort of free-floating idea. It needs some kind of institutional and physical space for it. And the university historically is that space. See, because the point is most disciplines could survive perfectly well by themselves in lots of different contexts. But they would then become inserted as a kind of expertise, as a kind of very specialized form of knowledge for another kind of end. So certainly the natural sciences, one can imagine this easily, but it's also true in the humanities and social sciences as well, especially if one thinks about, you know, the way in which social scientific knowledge can be implicated in, you think about the sort of things that in fact people are attracted to when they take social science degrees. They want to become probation officers, right? They want to be involved in social welfare. There are all these very practical kinds of areas where particular forms of knowledge in fact have a value, but it's not a value in themselves. Right? And in fact, the trajectories of those knowledges are entirely formed by those client populations that are in fact encouraging people to specialize in them. So the question then becomes, where do you go if you want to think about, you know, myself as a sociologist or yourselves, whatever disciplines you're in, as having more to do with, let's say, a philosopher, a chemist, you know, a person in literary criticism than, let's say, you know, the person who might employ it. See, where is the locus for that kind of attention, right? Where one can think about that there's an activity here that we all contribute to that should be promoted in some way, and that's the university, you see? And I think that is really threatened. And it's not just in terms of job market issues, but even those of you who are professional academics will know that the way in which we judge academic work in terms of their contributions to just specific disciplines, that we have this research assessment exercise, right? Even the quality stuff, right? It is judged discipline-based, and increasingly, part of the criteria that are used are, you might say, extrinsic criteria. Users and beneficiaries, to use that kind of lingo, right? And what this does then, it again encourages you to think in ways, you might say, in a centrifugal fashion with regard to the university, pulling it in part in the different directions to the different attractors in the larger society. But what happens then to the whole idea that all of this is a pursuit of knowledge? You know, as an autonomous inquiry that on its own terms can actually, transform and maybe even revolutionize society. Because historically there are lots of cases where this has in fact happened, where the university as an autonomous institution has allowed people the opportunity to develop their thoughts to a certain way, in a certain way, to meet up with other people, like in the case of the Nacionis that I was talking about, and thereby, have the sort of wherewithal to be able to go out and do something other than something that's just attracted by already existing market conditions. And that's why I think, however expensive and however seemingly uneconomical a university is as an institution these days, it is something that really does need to be protected in all of its integrity, and not just kind of parceled out or sort of turned into glorified car park. So I guess I'll stop that here and get some discussion. That's right, and I think universities there's a very particular version of this that affects universities, and this is associated in a way something in the United States and in continental Europe in particular, this issue of tenure, right? The idea that when you're hired for life, okay? Of course, after a certain probation period, whereby you're sort of judged to be whether you're kind of fit for this kind of responsibility, as it were. But the point is that the idea of having the job for life was to give you the kind of freedom to be able to pursue lines of inquiry to wherever they may lead without being immediately sensitive to market conditions in some kind of direct way. But if you see the percentage of jobs, so if let's say an old professor who's had the job for life retired, what are the odds that professor is going to be replaced by someone who's tenurable? odds are the person's going to be replaced by one or more, depending on the salary level of the professor, right? Untenured, temporary, part-time people who constantly will have to be demonstrating things, and will have to be demonstrating things in relation to the different market conditions that happen to be in place at the moment. So there's kind of a virtue place on being kind of jack of all trades, you might say, and being able to move with the times to be adaptive, right? But there is no incentive to sort of develop lines of inquiry that could actually take you in directions to go against that. Now, I think that kind of cuts against individualism, because in a sense it is individualistic in the sense of what you're talking about as being, you know, every man for himself, right? I certainly think individualistic at that level. But there's a sense in which there's another kind of individualism that one would associate with autonomy, or one, as it were, has the wherewithal to buck the trend. You know, where one is secure enough, and one's willing to take the risk. Because even if you get stuff wrong, even if people say your stuff is rubbish, at the end of the day, you're not going to lose your job. And I think there's a sense in which this is not presented in a sufficiently positive light, this aspect of academic life. I mean, it's often made to look like academics are useless. But the point is, this is a really very profound feature that, in fact, enables people to take a lot of risks. Because what's the worst that can happen if you're a tenured academic? You could say a lot of foolish things, people don't cite your work. Okay, big deal. But still, you have a job, right? And I think that aspect is what we're in threat of losing. Because, you know, we live in times, I mean, we've always lived in times where it is very difficult to pursue any kind of systematic, long-term line of thought unless you have some kind of financial security. And of course, financial security in the past, right, had to do with when you had an inheritance, right, or in fact, because the kind of work one typically did didn't require a lot of resources, you know, you could sort of do it in your spare time. You know, even natural sciences, well into the 19th century, could do things that way, right? They just, you know, they taught a certain number of days, and the weekends they were set up their experiments. But we don't live in that kind of period now. Now the issue of financial security really is very important. You know, even in social sciences, if you want to do the kind of surveys that typically, you know, are regarded as sort of gold standards for being able to say anything, I mean, you need grants, you need all kinds of stuff. You need a kind of security. And the problem is you're not institutionally guaranteed that security any longer. You have to always be buying it. And to buy it means you have to end up thinking in terms of what the market demands. So that's really, you know, and universities in the past allowed that kind of space. I think if I had to say what the fault of the universities in the past was it didn't require people to push the envelope. And so you did get a lot of deadwood in a tenured system. You did get a lot of people who sort of sat in their laurels and, you know, once they were, you know, they couldn't lose their job, they just sort of taught the same old courses for 25 years and nothing changed and there was nothing you could do about it. And I'm not going to deny that's a large part of the story, and that's one of the reasons why I think a lot of the younger generation, that is to say people who never lived in a tenured world, who are now entering into the academic world where it's all kind of very competitive, don't see what the value of tenure is. You know, what are all these guys who are around for 40 years doing the same thing over and over again? What's the value of this kind of institution? But that's where I think it needs to be sort of reinvented and reasserted, because that is going to be the only way you're going to get any really long-term significant thought taking place that's going to go against market conditions.
Just on that last point, I think you're right in the sense that it needs to be reinvented, because as I see it, I don't see any coherent contemporary concept of disinterested knowledge or autonomy.
Yeah.
I don't know what they mean anymore.
Yeah. Right? I know, and it is very much tainted by what the people see on the ground about what stands for autonomy, even without deadwood professors. That's absolutely right. But I think one of the things that one has to ask is where does one expect radical critical knowledge to come from, where the university is actually leading society as it's done in the past, rather than just following? I mean, one of the things that I think is really reprehensible about university leaders today, generally speaking, is that they're always followers. They're looking for where the trends are, and they're just sort of adapting and adjusting to make this, you know, kind of a marginal advantage, to get a marginal advantage. But what they're not doing is they're not leading in the way in which university presidents were doing in the 19th and 20th centuries. And I don't think this is out of the question, because I do think, actually, the whole idea of there being disinterested knowledge is something worth cultivating, especially in times where the economy changes very quickly, where whatever skills you have this week aren't necessarily going to be good next week. I mean, what are you going to have in the long term from your education if all you're doing is specializing in professional vocational skills these days. Right? Because it's not just universities that aren't tenuring people. People aren't being tenured anywhere. Right? And so what's the value of just having these immediately, you know, usable short-term skills? See, that's the kind of thing, and I think university presidents ought to be pushing this line much, much more strongly than they currently are as an advantage of the university. Especially in these neoliberal times.
Can I just say one thing?
Sure.
I'm sneaking out. Enjoyed the talk.
Yes.
At the beginning in Warwick, it might be worth noting that Students' Union and the staff didn't have their separate spaces. It was a notion that we would go back to an inclusive community. But clearly, in some sense, it was spurious. So the students had to fight quite hard to actually establish their own independent space.
Yeah.
Against this somewhat spurious inclusive community that in some idealistic way, the founders of the university started with. It's just a little remark.
Yeah.
It kind of throws a sort of deep line.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
On that note, it's also true that the...
Can you speak a little louder if you want to get on there?
Spatially, architecturally, an optional extra. You know, you can walk into it, but you can walk all around campus, do everything you need to, completely missing it by. But in my last university in York, due to the place of the library, the fact that there were all these bars all around campus, it tended to be the case that everyone would pass down a certain corridor all the time. So just accidentally, there was a real kind of communal zone where you tuck your posters up there and you leap with the people there. It's not really the same on this campus.
Yeah. But now the student union is supposedly, what, the largest in Europe? The one here. That's what they seem to advertise. I don't know.
Trade returns have been colossal. It's a big factor in what's happened here. I think it's not just about the relationship between students and the university. It's a business. It's a very successful big business, and that's how they operate. I've experienced some of those changes you were talking about, and I've been racking my brains trying to think of what links with all that is in the physical space, which included him. But I do recall that as that sort of loss of collegiality, which we used to complain about so much, hit us, and we stood around complaining, isn't it sad? We're no longer the collegial unit we ever were. We're now applying our own borough, and we're competing all the time, even competing with colleagues, you know, not just for sabbatical leave, but, you know, for own finance. Achievements and all that. One thing I noticed in one different university, we suddenly lost the common room. There was a big staff common room. And the sort of mini departments or groups within the institute started creating their own little rooms that were just for those groups. And it's in a sense that the accommodation committee were very pleased because they could turn the big common room into something else and got better value out of it. But it is interesting because what you've described is absolutely what's happened. But I wonder to what extent architects and planners are aware of what they're designing for these days, because it seems to be a very different sort of institution from the generally accepted model.
Yeah, no, I mean, one reason why I wanted to get a hold of this book, there is this book by Samuel, right, that actually talks about this kind of issue, it seems to me, in quite a lot of detail. There's a little copy of it out there. I do know that architects and universities often are in enormous conflict because of sort of images of what they think is supposed to be happening in the space, and that's kind of an interesting thing to look at in its own right. But I have to say that somebody who's designing a university these days from scratch, boy, I don't know what exactly they're going to be planning to do, right? I mean, because I think, you know, if you're talking about someone trying to do a new university, and unless they're trying to go back to some of the classical ideals, which, of course, there are exemplars for, but if they're trying to do something that sort of fits with what's happening now and trying to be sort of market savvy and so forth, I don't know what kind of architecture you'd want to come up with. You see, that's the thing. I mean, because in the sense of university, if you really are being this kind of market-driven university, why do you want to have some kind of common space, unless you want to highlight the ease with which one can get in and out of the place. Right? Because if you look at the kind of buildings that get, you know, the kind of things that get built on campuses these days as adjuncts, more parking, you know, hotels.
The alternative is something like the Open University, where you don't necessarily need a campus for every student to visit.
No, that's right. That's right, yeah, you can sort of rent the rooms whenever you need to meet with them, yeah. No, I mean, and in fact, well, I mean, that would, you know, in a sense, that wouldn't be so bad, but what I worry about is, we're going to a situation where it's going to be online teaching completely, and the academics are just going to be at home doing their stuff and emailing their papers or whatever, and so there, you know, there won't be a need for physical space. In fact, physical space will be seen as kind of a luxury that you'll have to pay rent on. I mean, they're already certain, I mean, well, I don't know, I'm not sure if it's true here, but in Scandinavian countries, generally, when you get a grant, part of the grant goes to paying rent for your office. Yeah, yeah, that's part of the overhead, to pay rent on the office specifically earmarked for that. And I could see that happening if it's, you know, especially when we get to an era where everybody's wired, you know, with the internet from their homes and stuff like this. And that office looks like a luxury.
It happens in East Anglia. Where space was then counted as part of the university's support of that department, and then they were charged accordingly, because the History of Art Department, which is based in the State History Centre at the University of Zagreb, occupied a vast space for a teaching staff, and being charged accordingly just blew their budget a bit.
I mean, these architectural issues are things that it would be really interesting to bring up next Wednesday.
Yeah, you're surprised it doesn't happen, right? We're the victims of all this.
So,
okay. Well, thank you. Thank you.
Please.